The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views.
One person was giddy.
Oh, yeah, that's Jim Hightower. He's going to be coming up later. We'll get back to that. It's so exciting to be with you again here at the new WHFR Journal, Local News and Alternative Views. Today is July 8th, 2011, and I'm joined in the studio by our WHFR News Director, Dennis Reimars. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, how are you?
And how was that farm market today? You went out there and braved the great outdoors.
I did. Actually, when I got there, there weren't very many people. A lot of vendors, but not a lot of customers participating. But by 15, 20 minutes later, and it must have been our news report, place was packed. And of course, I think. I mentioned to you what my wife was one of them, spending all of our hard-earned money.
But a lot of vendors, a lot of different kinds of natural foods, and probably... still some flowers.
Incredible. Everything you said.
That you might want to buy.
A lot of flowers. I was pleasantly surprised at the amount of produce. Of course, we got there about 10:30, but we were still able to get our 6 years of corn. You know, I mean, there was so much here. And I think I had also mentioned to you last week I wasn't here because I was in Oklahoma, the beautiful, beautiful town of Stillwater, Oklahoma, where it's 104 degrees. And I think that's their city slogan, where it's 104. No, actually, and then they have this unique... phrase they use when the weather gets up high. You know, here we call it a heat index. So if it seems hotter than it is, it's called the heat index and whatever. In Oklahoma, they call it a comfort level. And the comfort level was at 111, Jay.
Yeah, well, that's a lack of comfort level.
Thank you.
Actually,
thank you. That was my thought also.
Yeah, it's getting very hot down south. We should be lucky we're in Michigan because the drought, global warming, or what have you, cyclical, is really bad down there. Arizona through Texas, and I have visited in the past, and I sort of follow just for fun the temperatures in places like Tucson, Arizona.
Right.
It's been the highs have been averaging around 110 for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah,
and very little rain. And in Austin, Texas, they have been in close to 100 or over 100 for the last couple of weeks.
Well, my point was that the farm market in Oklahoma didn't have as many items because they were all, I don't know if they were bursting in the sun, but they weren't growing. They don't have a chance to pollinate at that heat. And here in Michigan, we don't have that problem.
Right.
So I was really happy to buy some corn from Britton, Michigan. wherever that is.
One of the stories in the paper, although I knew it personally, was that while you were out of town, Dennis, we were without power in about half of Dearborn, the east half of Dearborn, certainly my neighborhood, sometimes called Springwells Park Association area. And so that's Greenfield and Rotunda area, and also east of Greenfield, I guess, too, into that subdivision south of Michigan Avenue. Neighborhoods totally down. Also, the so-called TPC, the Tournament Players Golf Course, area that's gated condominiums. I think they are a gated community of individual homes. Right. I can't remember which their type they have. Maybe they have both there, but they were totally without power too for count them 68 hours.
Oh my gosh.
That was from last Saturday at 8 p.m. until Tuesday at 4 p.m. Maybe some people continued having no power longer than that. DTE actually called me just a couple hours ago and said, well, how was our service? And I said, well, it wasn't electricity for 68 hours. That assume you're not going to charge me. My meter wasn't running then,
That's
I assume.
Right.
And I said, we were all hoping it would be back up earlier, but understood that, you know, there was no DTE visible people working on July 4th. But then again, big-time holiday, people had plans to be out of town. I assume even to call them back on Saturday night. It might take them a day or so to get back. But and they did hire, and the woman was very nice, and because she probably had a lot of really nasty people. But it's nice that they tried to call anyway to give the impression that they were concerned. I said, I don't need the call. You just put the money, instead of the follow-up calls, put them into hiring people when the problem is there. And they did. They brought in electrical teams from outside the area, freelance, part-time electrical companies from all over to try to help. But the real work wasn't done until Tuesday. That's when we saw DTE and 5-6 trucks. And we had, in my area, we had five telephone poles where the power lines are, too, that were snapped in half.
Oh, my gosh.
They weren't just bent over or a couple lines came down. The poles were snapped in half, and the whole thing came down after
that.
What
happened?
It must have been squall-like, even though nobody said it was a tornado. But it sure looked like tornado because it was scattered all over the neighborhood, that there was monster tree branches down that wind alone couldn't do, and it didn't do it consistently either.
Right.
I mean, it did it here and there and over there.
Kind of erratic.
But you can't snap a telephone pole in half without some sort of tornado-like twisting winds. I mean, I was in my house and looking up through a window at the sky, which turned yellow. That's
right.
Usually a tornado-type thing when
sure.
the skies are very unusual in their color. And it only lasts about 10 minutes.
Right.
I mean, the squall that did the damage was, so I'm thinking it wasn't a sustained, 60-mile-an-hour winds
right.
for an hour or two. It just, for about 10 minutes, it was that bad, and power went out right away. Also, streetlights there, including the traffic light at Southfield and Rotunda, which is a big deal.
Right.
And that was out for like 3-4 days, too.
Wow.
So it was an amazingly quick disaster for about a third of Dearborn residences, I guess, that had lost power. And it was a long time. I mean, it was just a few hours less than the power outage back in 2003 that shut down most of the eastern, northeastern seaboards into
right.
Michigan. Although Henry Ford Community College here, WHFR, was not affected by power loss. And even in 2003, we were only down for about half a day at the college here. So WHFR could keep the messages going out. I thought with the summer theme, I would at least start with this story. Just, it's kind of a fun story, folks, from commondreams.org or shareable.net, where it originated. And this is sort of a follow-up to the 4th of July, in fact, from a J. Wall Jasper. That's his last name, Wall Jasper. First name is mine, so I was immediately attracted, of course. It's got to be a worthy comment. He says, on the 4th of July, my wife Julie and I were biking down through downtown Minneapolis to see fireworks at the Mississippi River when someone shouted at us, "Take your clothes off!" We weren't sure whether to be offended or flattered until realizing we had pedaled into the midst of a naked bicycle ride. Well, not quite naked, he goes on to say, but several hundred people on bikes were approaching us in their underwear, skimpy underwear without a stitch of Lycra, which is typical for bicyclists to wear skin-tight lycra. He says they were having a great time on a still 85-degree summer evening, and so was everyone watching them. It was a welcome bit of fun and a downcast holiday weekend here in Minnesota. Right now, the state government is shut down, and I think it still is, isn't it? Because of a political budget battle, which means that many public services on which people depend are closed. That includes state parks and construction projects and state highways, which explains why more people than usual were in town to watch fireworks and near naked bike riders. It's a similar story all across the country as Americans struggle with unemployment, rising gas prices, and steep cuts in vital services. The boom in biking that's happening coast to coast offers at least one bright spot amid all the gloomy news. People on bikes save money, save gas, save the environment, and make fewer demands on the public treasury than motorists. A mile of new urban highway costs, I guess depending on the terrain, between $46 and $100 million. For just 1 mile. I don't know if that's four lanes or eight lane divided or whatever, but $46 to $100 million per mile. That was according to a former House Representative Transportation Chairman Jim Oberstar. While a mile of 12-foot wide bikeway, and that's really nice, you can almost get three bikes side by side and bikes can pass you. So a mile of a bikeway only cost $125,000. So, you know, so much cheaper, obviously, so much cheaper. Biking also improves our health, cuts healthcare costs, reduces air pollution as an alternative to other kinds of transportation, fights global warming, prevents traffic congestion. You know, cars, they exhaust, include CO2.
Right.
And that contributes to the global warming, of course. Reclaims the streets as shared space, and the list goes on and on. And he says,
save on clothing costs.
Well, yeah, maybe if you're naked or nearly naked. Yesterday, the New York Times ran a blog outlining the numerous economic benefits of increasing bicycle ridership. And so that would have, this is from July 7th, so that New York Times article, you could just Google, or I'm just saying, use their search engine to look for bicycles. There and get the New York Times blog statements about that. He says, in fact, you could say the hundreds of bicyclists wheeling through Minneapolis on the 4th, both those in underwear and everyone else, were exhibiting their patriotism. So how do we get more Americans to bike? The biggest obstacle right now is that people see bicyclists as an exotic species, macho, ultra-fit, almost entirely young, white and male, clad in lycra or spandex, who ride like madmen all over city streets. Some of us admire them, some revile them, but most other people can't imagine joining their ranks. Yet, the reality is that most bikers today are ordinary people. Office workers, commuting, school kids going to piano practice or a soccer game, moms with a trailer on the back of their bike, actually. Yeah. Grandparents getting exercise, too. We simply remember the daredevil bike messengers and wannabe Lance Armstrongs in racing gear more vividly. In fact, I've been watching, I think it's the 6th or now, it's today, it's the 7th day of the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. And that's in France. They have a 30-day-long bike race. 30 days. That's all around the country. Up hills, down mountains, all the stuff, all the speed trials, and it's just an amazing, probably the most challenging endurance physical event that has ever been designed. At least I don't know about the early days of the Roman Olympics and so on, or the Greek Olympics. But
it's a little far back for you to remember.
Yeah, but and I've actually been in France once in my college days, and we actually happened to be in cities during that month where, by God, it, you know, a certain time of day, here they come, right. All a couple thousand bike racers, get out of the road, Koronik, you know. I mean, oh my God, here they come. And of course, they're biking like crazy and going pretty fast, although not through the cities, you can't, because the turns and that, you can't go as fast. But
I would say that's the most grueling. I was going to say the Iditarod, but of course, the dogs are doing all the work. And it's
not
just
30 days.
It's 1,200 miles or something?
Yeah, I mean, there are timed sections, and you're not riding 24 hours a day. You know, you do get a chance to sleep and eat, but your times are kept track of while you're sleeping and eating, and then you start just like everybody after, you know, 8 hours of rest or whatever again.
Right.
So it's quite grueling, and those people are the ones that wear the spandex and the, you know, they're low on the seats and bent over. But it's interesting that some of the top riders currently, and it's only like a week into that month long race, the Tour de France, and that they're close to 40.
Yeah.
Lance Armstrong, I think, was over 40 when he won the last time. He won six times, did he? Almost a or maybe it was a record, battling cancer for the first couple of years that he rode. And so it's, but it's not that. It's not, you know, it can be for everybody, and bicycle sales are definitely increasing. And we do want to recommend here, I won't finish the article, but you get the idea that it is very patriotic to ride a bike to work. Or to a bus stop, and then, you know, to even Detroit buses, amazingly, if you can get to one, they actually have a bike rack on the front, and you have to take charge to go and hook it up yourself before you get on the bus, but that's what it's there for. Of course, you know, there's only like four or five bikes at most, maybe two or three, that they can get on that rack before right. the rack is filled. So that everybody rides a bus can't obviously have a bike with them, unfortunately. But it's not a bad idea. And wherever you can do it, definitely do it. By the way, the underwear bike rides, not really naked, as we said, with very skimpy clothing, have taken place in Chicago, Milwaukee, San Diego, Mexico, Dallas, Denton, Dallas and Denton, Texas, and other towns. Some places around the world, including Portland, Los Angeles, Madison, San Francisco, and Montpelier, Vermont, go even farther with naked bike rides. These events embody, so to speak, biking's reputation as a hip form of transportation. So going farther, who can only guess what that means?
I think they just go a longer distance.
Yeah, well, okay. thanks for cleaning that up.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
But he just says he's been predicting that in the future, biking will be seen as utterly normal and incredibly sexy. He says, by normal, I don't mean people, I mean people don't consider it weird for someone like them to do it. By sexy, I don't just mean Penelope Cruz or Brad Pitt. I mean, it's vital, healthy, refreshing. You look good using your muscles. You feel good with the wind in your face, and you're happy, smiling, and alive. He says, even if you never strip down to your underwear, which may be illegal in Michigan, so you better check your local laws on that. But that's I just wanted to get started with that because of the lack of power. I mean, we still had cars that had gas in them. They were still pumping gas at gas stations. Interesting to me that all the stores and businesses, even the Wendy's across from our neighborhood, they all had power.
Yeah.
They must have different power lines connected to them because I'm thinking, well, that sure helped their business. The Coney Island by me did a great business for 3 days because nobody... Really, I mean, once your food spoiled and you had to toss it out, you couldn't eat it at home anymore unless
right.
you had a grill. So,
most people wanted to go where there was air conditioning, I'm sure.
I actually got used. It was 90 degree temperatures, highs for those 3 days.
Okay.
And it was clear. And for those, it was so Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And I actually got used to it. We had to put all the windows up.
Sure.
And, you know, the first day was unbearable, but then you sort of got used to the little bit of breeze and your body acclimatized to the 90. And then I remember on Tuesday evening, I went somewhere after the power came back up, though, and it was air conditioned. I started sneezing and coughing.
Did you really?
Because of the air conditioning.
All right.
You know? So it's all what you can, all what you're going to be adjusted to, too.
Do you think you'll get rid of your air at your house now?
No, but... I think it's an interesting idea. You want to save on power and energy.
Yeah.
All of us just plan to do without for 1 day a week. Sounds
okay.
radical.
It does.
I mean, I know the people that have a resuscitation device at home or something.
Right.
I mean, medical reasons.
Your life depends on it, obviously.
And then the crazy people, three people in our neighborhood of about 200 homes, they turned on their generators,
all right.
their gas generators.
There's always one.
So monster loud. I guess they never heard about mufflers on generators.
Oh, no kidding.
I'm sure it broke every Dearborn sound regulation, you know, for boomboxes or what. I mean, it was just terrible, of course, compared to the total silence without them. I mean, a few crazed people who were able to clear enough of the branches off that they could use their, of course, gas-powered mowers, they did that. And then they had to use their gasoline-powered blowers. But most people, they didn't clear the yards because it was too many branches. They had to cut the branches
right.
apart first. And so it was really quiet for like the first 2 days, and that was fantastic. Although in radio, we don't like quiet because
no.
then you'll change the channel.
Well, it
or
depends
go to
who's
television,
on the air, doesn't it? yeah.
All right. Got to go to the stories here, folks. It's about, 18 minutes past the hour. The new WHFR Journal, local news, alternative views. Jay Kornick and Dennis Reimar is with you for the rest of the hour from the Press and Guide last Sunday. And it's interesting that the headlines for the Press and Guide last Sunday said no date or month. It says, you know, insert date month here. They didn't change it before they published.
Oh, no.
That somebody forgot to go to the word processing file. And so
here, Dennis. You won't find that at the Mirror News.
It says Sunday, but then it says month, date, comma.
Awesome.
And so they had not updated that. So it's the month's date edition of the Press and
that
Guide.
That is brilliant.
From July, from 2011 at least, we know that. Yeah. Jury awards $732,000 in suit against District Judge Summers, the second ruling against him in a month. The other case was $460,000-some-odd. Right. There's a question, the district judgeships, does their money come from Wayne County or does Dearborn make a contribution?
Right.
Somebody is out $1,200,000 now. And the bad news is there's a third similar case against Summers and his district court from another disgruntled employee. Interesting to me that the same lawyer, and as we know from previous information that came out in the Press and Guide even, primarily paid for by Judge William Hultgren of the district court. And there's no positive relationship between the two of them. And primarily because in this last case, it was his live-in lover, now fiancée, Julie Pucci, who was specifically involved in this last case. And so he now has a very rich friend, and I suggest tying the knot as quickly as possible.
That was fun. I just caught what you're saying.
Okay.
I just found a spelling error or an error in the Times Herald version of the same story.
Right, it's also covered in the Times Herald.
Whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Well, good. See, nobody's perfect here.
I'll be the first to tell
you
that.
Doesn't know what the date is or the month, and Times Herald gets some words spelled wrong. What can we say there? Well, it's a question of who has to pay that money. There are appeals that Summers is doing. They're trying to get the verdict set aside by the judge in the first case. When that usually doesn't happen, but you can ask.
Right.
And the second case, and it's interesting, Summers' comments, reactions, he said, well, sometimes good people don't win.
That's what Summers said. He was disappointed by that.
Well, obviously, although I don't believe he has to pay either amount, but it could look very bad the next time he campaigns that someone obviously wanting to be judged next time around and not necessarily funded by Hultgren, although I bet they will be, will use that in campaign literature again. He cost our district courts $1,200,000, you know, and that's always... looks like a negative, so
well, and you don't want to give your opponent anything when you have something this juicy,
right?
You know,
yeah,
three lawsuits, two against him and one potentially against him. That's a lot of money,
right. And it depends on how you apparently look at. It's not that he did anything that wrong as the head judge in the district, appointed chief judge in the district by the courts above him. He made certain administrative decisions in order to save money. And he felt that in the first case that the person was able to be let go for financial reasons without giving just cause. And that was, he thought, the tradition of that situation. The jury somehow disagreed in the first case, the $460,000 case.
Right.
In the second, again, several reasons, and only the court would really be able to fairly assess all the details here. But the second case, primarily, it seems to me, was that Julie Pucci, because of her relationship, her living with William Hultgren, that could be a conflict of interest. I mean, she's an administrator. She could affect some of the outcomes of the cases since she and the judge had this intimate relationship, which we're not saying anything against here on WHFR. And by the way, we have a wonderful disclaimer, and I pre-recorded it, so I got to play it. It's my own voice, so who cares? But anyway, here's our disclaimer.
Are you serious?
Now that I'm going to state another opinion.
I go away for a week and you do this?
I pre-recorded this. Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students. Well, that's as succinct as I could get, and I didn't even make the usual joke that we hope somebody agrees with us, right. You know, some of the time. So,
well,
anyway,
I thought it was very well done.
Because we're expanding, time for a little plug here, we're expanding our talk shows to a Monday night slot, that there will be people talking, saying words, not necessarily playing much music. On Mondays now, in addition to Tuesdays from noon to 2, and of course Fridays for the journal that you're listening to now from 1 to 2 p.m. on Fridays, but also Monday from 6 to 7 p.m., so it's the evening edition, a new talk show time, and we'll be debuting Parent Connection in that time slot starting in August.
Cool.
Once a month, and the other nights are open to a number of podcasts that I'm getting from great nonprofits on the internet, like Sierra Club has a weekly radio podcast, as does many other groups. So we're going to be doing a variety of things until we can also encourage and open up the time to other WHFR staff members that might want to do a special topic talk show, so alternative to what you can hear on commercial radio.
So, and to explain it, it's kind of like if people listen on the Tuesday, where we have our normal forum shows from mm-hmm. Tuesday from 1 to 2, just prior to that, from 12 to 1, you have a wonderful science show.
That's right.
And it'll be kind of like that. Is that what you're saying with the rest of the Mondays other than the Parent Connection?
It certainly will be.
Okay.
And I'm just grabbing here for the, let's see what we can find here.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I was just curious if it was going to be the same show each Monday, or if you were going to rotate it for different shows for that spot.
Yeah, well, since we've got a lot of open hours on the first, second, and third, and the fifth Monday, when that will happen, it's going to be a variety of things. We'd like people to comment on what they like hearing regularly, and we'll try to continue those if they like it. Although in most cases, as we will indicate on the shows, during the shows, they can also go directly on the internet to those websites and listen to them anytime they want to also. But we just want to introduce you to some new things there. Where the heck is it here? Okay. Oh, it's in the other folder.
I do know that this Tuesday at 1 o'clock, you'll hear two fine young people named Lindsay and Dennis.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this this show called Campus. Actually, yeah, Lindsay and I will be in the studio live. We recorded the last show because she was out of town. But we will be back and doing it live, which I think I've told you, Jay, it's so much better. It's so much different. I don't mind recording. It was a great experience. But doing it live, it's just a dynamic that I really enjoy. And of course, then Lindsay is so awesome as a co-host. So we'll be Tuesday at 1 o'clock, and I know we have a lot of things to go. Even though there's not a ton going on at the school, as people know, it's a summer term here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more relaxed. In fact, we're only open Monday through Thursday, but we have a number of things we can talk about for this upcoming show.
Absolutely. Here's the new promotional announcement that we're running now for our science talk show. Same show, but they got a new title. Oh my goodness, listen to this. Seth Shostak and Molly Bentley.
The size of blood cells, Earth-like planets outside the solar system.
Science fiction?
No, science faction. Join us, Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
WHFR, each Tuesday at noon for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science steps back to get the wide-angle view on science and technology, from where they've been to where they're headed.
So think big. Big Picture Science. You'll find it here on WHFR.FM every Tuesday at noon.
We're making waves on WHFR 89.3.
And we thank our folks. No, it's not time for Highway 61. Boy, this computer is really ready
fast
to go today.
Yeah,
it's quicker than the humans.
That was an excellent. It was so great to hear the two of them. Kind of a promo for us.
They just. I wanted them actually when we started using their show, which had some other title. The title was misleading. The title is the now Big Picture Science, and it really does a great, entertaining job of giving you background on science issues. And it's not boring, but it gets you involved
right
with real people and in real situations or in dramatized fantasy situations, like they're flying on a spaceship, and what are they talking about as they go approaching a black hole? And that's called in old time radio theater of the mind.
Oh, they're very good at it,
and they just do it a fantastic job. So you really do learn things about the latest issues in science. Usually, each show is thematic. Sometimes they. They do what they call a skeptic check, which is a number of stories about some crazy ideas that have no basis in science that are circulating in the last month. But it's a new show every week, and they call it now Big Picture Science, and we feature it here uniquely, exclusively in the Detroit area on WHFR.FM. Another reason we're making waves. So I don't think we can say too much else about the Summers case. I know some people will hold this against him. Other people may know that... he has a strong Christian religious background, although he's never been criticized in any case having to do with Muslims or other religions. But he's tried to apparently hang a plaque or something in the courtroom that had quotes from the Bible. I don't know if that actually happened or not. Sometimes he admonishes guilty defendants with quotes from the Bible. So that obviously the Christian Bible is a basis for his morality and ethical judgments as he applies the laws of our land. Now that, again, he can't be criticized about that unless he's doing something that's not according to our basic laws. Whether or not these staffing issues where he had to cut back and he had to lay people off and he was sensitive about conflict of interest, larger courts, juries, have disagreed with his rulings in those cases. He still thinks he was totally right to do it that way. I can only say is that the lawyer's pay is primarily coming from the other judge, District Judge William Hultgren, which he has a right to do. He has a legal right to do that, although he certainly had a personal interest and conflict of interest in a way in regard to Julie Pucci. But I wish everybody well, and I'm just sorry that in these difficult economic times, somebody's budget got hit for at this point, $1,200,000.
And I just wish the article went into a little more detail as to how they came up with that number. Like, for what reason you give her $700,000? You know what I mean?
Well, I always wonder. I mean, the first case, it was $460,000 because of potential future, past and future earnings lost
right
from that full-time job. Does Julie Pucci's job pay twice as much in that same sort of calculation?
It's been 4 years.
Do they calculate, 10 years more in the future or all the way to retirement age?
That's
Julie
a good
Pucci,
question.
The picture there looks like she could be in her late 30s. I'm not sure if she's into her 40s. There was a picture included in the press and guide from the Durrani swearing-in ceremony,
okay.
the Wednesday edition.
Is that it?
Do you have it? No. Oh, it's the Wednesday edition of Press and Guide there. Okay, well, it's in the back. Dennis has got this. I got to show Dennis the picture so he can guess at Julie Pucci's age.
I'm really bad at this.
Oh, my goodness. 4A?
No. Well, they go over a lot of different things, but sometimes doesn't it seem like the number's inflated? I mean,
I can't find it, but...
That's all right. Yeah. I'm sure she's the age you said. But the point is that and they have to pay the lawyer, too, don't they? We have to remember that.
Yeah, well, he gets a percent of... There it is. He gets a percent of the compensation. So sometimes 10%, sometimes 20%. Depends on the lawyer. So he will get, if it's 10% out of the first two cases, $120,000.
Right. I think you were a little conservative at her age. That's all.
Ah, okay.
They're a very handsome
conservative
couple.
Old or young?
I don't know. Either way, yes. I'm not going to go because I may end up in court one day. Anyway, so on to the next story we have.
Oh, Dennis wants us to move along. Okay.
I do.
Well, in Dearborn Heights District 7, which is not all of Dearborn Heights, but it's a district that's somehow tied to the Dearborn School District. I don't know if we oversee or what, but all of the staff there agreed to contract concessions, including paying 35% of healthcare costs. Now, many state employees and other school districts, they have now been forced to pay up to 20%.
Right.
They're going to pay 35% of their healthcare costs, which is a nice thing to do in difficult economic times. But I don't know what they were threatened with. And it's, you know, that's below even the private sector contributions, as Governor Snyder's reminder is, well, private sector people pay 20% of the healthcare costs. Well, where does, so it's great that they don't need the money, but I don't know, they must have been really heavily blackmailed into that 35% cut. That's all I can figure, and I think that's totally wrong for our school systems and our employees to have to suffer that burden. And it's pretty much all of a sudden. Previously, they had it all paid for. So, and those costs are huge. Editorial in the Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday, undated edition, that they want to get the new second bridge built. Let's get the ball moving, they said. Not the wrecking ball. No, it's a new construction.
That would be further down
the governor's for that. Right. Well, I wish it would be. I mean, apparently the plan right now is just like just less than a quarter mile down the river. So it's still Detroit. It's still downtown Detroit. But that's where they're going to put the second bridge.
Huh.
Obviously, the downriver people would love to have a span, although it may have to be longer, originating in Wyandotte.
Sure.
In the Wyandotte area. That would really help downriver in business. But I think it might be a longer span, more expensive. I don't know, but it does seem a little bit wrong somehow to have it just, you know, a stone's throw away, or you'd have to really be powerful to throw a stone a quarter mile, I guess. But I don't understand that, but I don't think it's going to be very far away from the ambassador right now.
It doesn't make much sense. But the goal might be to have it be in the area in Windsor where there's actually businesses, because I know further downriver, it's more residential there. And that may not actually, it's kind of wide open and undeveloped in some areas.
I think they just want access to the major expressways, east, west, north, south. And as you know, I-94 goes into downtown Detroit. So that is a little bit closer to get going in the direction you want if you've got trucks that have to continue driving somewhere.
But that's all served by the Ambassador Bridge and the tunnel right now.
And there's a lot of warehouses in downtown Detroit that are still active. In other words, the trucks come across, they unload there in Detroit, and then smaller truck lines come and then distribute it throughout the U.S.
Right.
So Wyandotte may not have those extra facilities at this point, but I'm sure they would be willing to start building them. So we'll see where that goes. That we don't have the details, but they're supporting Governor Snyder's position, which very slowly, the Republican majority in the Senate and the House, I think, are turning to his idea. But he wanted to have it finalized before they broke for the summer, and that didn't happen. He said that in an interview a couple months ago. Oh, we got to get that bridge finalized before the summer. Well, it didn't happen. We hope we have a call in to get George Durrani, our local state representative, to Lansing in the studio with us and ask him some specific questions about what happened in the last term. And what he thinks might happen in the near future when they get back in session in September. At least I think it's September anyway. Still no word about police fire staffing being on the ballot here in Dearborn. But they may actually try to put something on the ballot that reverses or temporarily sets aside the minimum staffing for police and fire that are part of the Dearborn City Charter right now. I thought it was interesting in the story, which is from the July 6th Wednesday edition of the Press and Guide. The staffing that's required by the charter has never been, those levels had never been met by the city. The city's been in violation of the charter since 2004, 2006. They have never hired enough staff, even though it's a legal requirement.
It's because the money wasn't there.
That's no excuse.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's their reason.
It's not an excuse.
Oh, you're right.
It's somehow the firefighters' unions or union that haven't pushed the issue, taken them to court. And I'm not sure why. That's a very interesting question. If we get the Dearborn fire chief here, the Dearborn police chief, Haddad here, I didn't even think of asking him about, because everybody said, well, we passed it. They must have minimum staffing.
Sure.
They have not. Well, that's saving the city a little money, but that's not what the will of the people wanted. So I'm a little bit upset with city government if we get anybody representing the government, the mayor or anyone, the council here, we're definitely going to ask them, what the heck is going on there? I mean, obviously, the city is not burned down or crime has not increased with not having the minimum staffing required by the charter. But how can we go so many years when that's the law of the land? Isn't any, who should be enforcing that? Does it take that lawsuit from the firefighters union in order to make the city do the right thing? So I think the city's got a little guilt here. I don't know. I don't think I want to vote for less staffing, even if it's temporary. Although, guess what? The article seems to indicate that the firefighters unions, the firefighters in general, oh, they're already negotiating for even less staffing.
So a shorter minimum.
Just to help benefit the city.
Interesting.
So sweet people they are, but what about the law of the land here? You know, and of course that's not where the costs really are. The cost increases not in terms of staffing, but in the pensions involved with the staffing and the healthcare costs, which are constantly going up. Both of those, and you know, something has to be done there. And sometimes it's out of the city's control, but it has to be financed somehow. So as another story in the Press and Guide from July talks about Dearborn Heights, that the city council there, a person on the council, Janet Badham, is that what she's called? No, councilperson Badham. Okay. She said, look, we need to find out how to reduce the deficit. It looks like we're going to be in deficit. That, you know, all the money hasn't been coming in. And so they don't know whether in Dearborn Heights that they should put something on the ballot for November. This is a Dearborn situation. They have to decide by sometime in July, this month, within the next week or two, what to put on that ballot in November if they need additional millage.
Right.
So are they going to cut staffing? Are they going to, you know, earmark 3.5 mils for the pools or for whatever?
Do you know at what point they have to make that decision for it to
go
on the ballot?
Soon. Okay. Yeah, as I said, before the end of this month. I'm not sure the exact date.
Okay.
And because it's even Dearborn Heights Council is under the same gun here. And it's interesting that the mayor in Dearborn Heights, Dan Politko, has said, well, we've got Plant Moran, their efficiency accounting people, coming in to look at our budget and make recommendations for either cuts or the need for new financing. So they won't even be done with their job until after the deadline passes.
Hmm.
So what do you do there? I mean, I think Dearborn kind of already knows the economic situation they're going to be in.
Right.
And so in Dearborn Heights, they don't know what to do. Do they put something on the ballot and then some sort of caveat? Like, if we don't need to do this, we won't. Well, I don't know if voters can trust you in that
no,
way.
No.
If you don't really need to do it, why ask us in the first place?
Right.
It just looks like they're going to be in a deficit situation for 2011 to 2012 at this point. And they really should take action on a yearly budget basis so that they're not in debt at the end of that year. But they don't know whether to ask or not, because Plant Moran had just started their accounting, and I guess they can't work night and day to finish it quicker. I'd like to go to both Jim Hightower comments, one from July 6th, one from the 7th. They both have to do with the war in Afghanistan, and how does that tie in with Dearborn? I'll explain after you listen to Hightower's comments, and both very strongly worded. Just to get you thinking. Here's Jim Hightower.
America's long, long war in Afghanistan has drained more than 1,500 precious lives and about $500 billion from our country. But finally, this enormous outlay paid off with the capture and killing of that Al-Qaeda demon, Osama bin Laden, who attacked America and was the reason our military went into Afghanistan. Oh, wait. Osama wasn't in Afghanistan, was he? He was comfortably ensconced in Pakistan, whose leaders are supposedly our allies. And it wasn't the costly Afghan war effort that got bin Laden. It was old-time spy work, culminating in a raid involving a small team of Navy SEALs, a dog, and two helicopters. So why have two presidents and a decade of Congresses dumped so many lives and so much money into a country that poses no threat to us? Hardly a powerhouse, Afghanistan is an impoverished, anarchic, largely illiterate land of ancient tribal factions and fractious warlord fiefdoms. They have no desire or ability to attack us. The only reason we're given for being in Afghanistan is that we must keep Al-Qaeda terrorists from establishing bases there. But, like bin Laden, Al-Qaeda left this country years ago and now operates transnationally in Pakistan, Yemen, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, including England and Germany. Yet, we're told we must continue to pour American lives and dollars into Afghanistan. But why? To create a central, democratically elected government with a 300,000-member army and police force, we're told. But why? To stabilize the country, they say. But why? To keep al-Qaeda out, they repeat, closing the endless loop of a Kafkaesque rationale. This is Jim Hightower saying, President Obama has finally started a slow withdrawal of U.S. troops, but that'll take at least 3 years, more than $300 billion, and untold numbers of shattered lives. The question remains, why?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
One person was giddy with excitement upon hearing President Obama's announcement that all of America's combat troops would depart from Afghanistan by 2014. Hamid Karzai. A moment of happiness for Afghanistan, exulted the incurably corrupt, inept, weak, and pompous Afghan president. Our leaders put this ingrate in power, and the lives of our soldiers and billions of our tax dollars have been spent to prop up his sorry excuse for a government, yet he's the one saying, good riddance. It puts the dumb in dumbfounding. The dumbest and most shameful aspect of America's 10-year Afghan war is the pretension that Karzai represents some flowering of democracy. Nonsense. Installed in the presidency by dictate of the Bush-Cheney regime in 2002, he's widely despised and ridiculed by Afghans and has clung to power through fraud and autocratic power plays. For example, in last year's parliamentary contest, Karzai was PO'd that 62 candidates he favored lost or were disqualified by the country's Independent Election Commission because of fraud. So Hamid haughtily set up his own special court to review those results. The day after Obama's withdrawal announcement, Karzai's kangaroo court disqualified the 62 parliamentary winners, replacing them with his chosen ones. Of course, the 62 winners are refusing to budge from their seats, which has created a governmental stalemate. But this suits Karzai perfectly, for the stalemate allows him to rule without parliament. As a top opposition leader puts it, Karzai does not believe in the rule of law. He thinks democracy doesn't work in his favor. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's both insane and immoral for our leaders to cause even one more American to die for Karzai. Tell Obama to bring all of our troops home pronto. The White House comment line is 202-456-1111.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
And we're back. We never left. Are you still there? I hope so. Well, how does Jim Hightower's comments about the Afghan war and really ending all war and bringing money home affect relate to Dearborn? Well, Mayor O'Reilly actually attended a big national conference of U.S. mayors. It happens every year. Where's the story? Okay, what did I do with it? Okay, here we go. And it's called the U.S. Mayor's Conference. And would you believe the conference first started in the year 1932, and the city they all came together in for that first meeting was Detroit. In the midst of the Great Depression, the city that needed the most help of all, and today it may still be true, they came to Detroit. This time they went to Baltimore, which is indie filmmaker John Waters' hometown, where he always makes jokes about nothing ever happens in Baltimore, and they still make jokes about rolling up the sidewalks after 6 p.m.
Wasn't Edgar Allan Poe?
Oops, he's not on. Why aren't you on? There you are, Dennis.
Wasn't Poe from Baltimore?
No, he was found dead in a gutter in Baltimore, I think.
So indirectly, he's from there. Sorry. No, you're right. You're right. But that's where he was.
He had to die in the gutter because the sidewalks were already rolled up.
There's no place else to walk. Oh, good.
Anyway, Baltimore is where they had the conference, and the mayors passed a couple of resolutions. And one is one that we even heard on this show Mayor O'Reilly give support to, and now all, or at least the vast majority of U.S. mayors attending this conference also said what? Bring the war dollars home. And here's the story. I've had it for a while. From June 20th, they had this press release. Mayors from around the U.S. met in Baltimore this week to set public policy for the millions of people living in big cities depending on municipal services to stay safe. While Congress considered allocating another $118 billion to conduct wars next year, and President Obama absurdly maintained that the costly bombing of Libya is not an act of war and thus not subject to congressional oversight, mayors listened to the people. And so they passed a motion saying the United States Conference of Mayors calls the U.S. Congress to bring these war dollars home to meet vital human needs, promote job creation, rebuild our infrastructure, aid municipal and state governments, and develop a new economy based upon renewable, sustainable energy. That's the kind of support that I've been saying, too. I mean, I'm not in favor of government, you know, putting money into everything, but we got to get us redirected here away from foreign oil. And whether you believe it's going to help the environment or not, to save us money in the long run, we have to get into renewable energy for homes, for cars, for businesses. And that's not happening. The startups aren't doing it. They need help. They need money from the federal government. It's the only way it's going to happen big and quick. And by the way, how much did we spend on war last year? $126 billion. Wars that arguably have no purpose anymore. Now, that's the opinion of yours truly and the U.S., you know, Conference of Mayors. So there, by the way, 6,000 U.S. troops have died. Okay. This is in addition to, of course, the 3,000 we lost in 9/11. But let's not forget that, yes, they killed 30,000 enemy combatants. You know, the soldiers of Iraq defending Iraq. I mean, they were told to, Iraqi soldiers. And so we invaded, they fought because their leader said, fight and defend your country. Soldiers in Afghanistan who were fighting because their government said, fight and defend your country. So 30,000 combatant enemy troops were killed by us in that time. But we should not forget a very rough and conservative estimate of 150,000 innocent people in Iraq and Afghanistan who've also died because we killed them. Okay, collateral damage, as they say. Okay, should be some guilt that we feel about that, as well as the tragedy of 6,000 of our own troops. But why are we still there in Iraq and Afghanistan? Why? I think, again, Hightower said it, I don't have to, but the U.S. Mayor's Conference, and I know it was the opinion of Mayor O'Reilly. He said right on this show when we had him here during the pledge drive last April in this year, and he said, I'm in favor of that. I'm in favor of ending the wars and getting the money back here. I think Obama's now calling it nation building at home.
That's right.
But he didn't stop the money flowing over there, so when's that going to happen? I mean, oh, we have to sort of go down slowly. That's not what the U.S. mayors have agreed, just so you know, along with Mayor O'Reilly.
Well, it's funny how some things are phased out slowly and some things are abruptly changed and dropped. And it's an arbitrary process, apparently.
By the way, this resolution, it grew slowly. Talk about grassroots. Is a woman who lives in Windham, Maine, mm-hmm. wherever Windham, Maine is. Her name is Sally Breen. She's obviously a peace activist, but she got started with the same exact resolution that I just read about stopping the war, bringing the money home, and it was called Bring Our War Dollars Home campaign, and she got it adopted back in 2010 on Martin Luther King Day in Maine by their state legislature. And the same resolution spread across the country, getting various groups to agree to it. A woman-led peace group is called Code Pink. Okay. I'd heard of Code Pink. I didn't know it was a women-led peace group, Code Pink. And Deer Isle, Portland, and School Administrative District 74, also in Northampton and Amherst, Massachusetts, and most recently the city of Hartford, Connecticut, approved of it. Well, she got it all the way up to the U.S. Mayor's Conference, and they approved of it too. So just shows you how grassroots groups and just keeping at persevering can maybe turn things around. So far, hasn't turned anything around, but at least larger and larger groups are adopting that same resolution, and maybe someday our congressman will also get the word. Second thing the U.S. Mayor's Conference adopted on June 23rd was a resolution that has actually been a resolution that is trying to become a law in the United States Congress from a senator, Senator Webb, introduced the same legislation in 2009, which actually passed the House last year, but was blocked in the Senate. He's a senator, Senator Jim Webb, Democrat, Virginia. And that is, it cites the nation's high incarceration rate. We have so many people in prison, and I think Michigan is number one, percentage-wise, of people in prison
right.
in the state, population-wise. And also calling the war on drugs a failure. All the money that's trying to fight the illegal importation, selling, distribution of drugs, and it hasn't worked. It was started under Richard Nixon.
Right.
It just has not worked. And so that resolution to stop the war on drugs of the sort that they're doing and have been trying to do, and to stop somehow sending people to prison for maybe having, a marijuana cigarette on them or two, the U.S. Council of Mayors, Conference of Mayors has said, that's got to be stopped. It's got to be reformed. And by the way, that same legislation is supported by the National Sheriff's Association, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Fraternal Order of Police, something called the Sentencing Project, which has to do with prisons,
sure.
the NAACP, the American Civil Liberties Union, and a group called the Prison Fellowship.
You're saying all these extra groups are where they agree with the mayor's their decision?
Right. They want to support what's called the National Criminal Justice Commission Act,
okay.
which would create a bipartisan commission to conduct bipartisan. Is that possible?
Yeah.
A bipartisan Let's commission see. To conduct an 18-month review of each facet of the nation's criminal justice system with the goal of reshaping and reforming it completely. Because we know we got too many people in prison. And they keep going back because they love it there, I guess.
Yeah, apparently.
And we've got this so-called war on drugs. It's a failure. The point maybe you remember about the war on drugs thing, the war on drugs project or funding, it provided that really stupid idea that we should allow all these gun sales to happen illegally. Was it in Texas? And then try to track them back to drug dealers in Mexico.
I remember that.
But in fact, it just caused those weapons to be used in more criminal battles with our own enforcement people and border people. So it just blew up in their face. In other words, they actually financed all these guns and weapons and allowed them to be sold to criminals so as to track them to their source and then go after. And it didn't work that way at all. It's just another complete crazy idea. I mean, they've had surveillance aircraft over Mexico, over Colombia. That's part of the war on drugs. And they get shot down, and we got to go rescue the pilots. And they've made a few Hollywood movies about that. It hasn't worked. It hasn't stopped the flow of drugs. And so that whole program under the umbrella term war on drugs, it hasn't worked. We still need to do things there, but it's got to be stopped. It's just crazy. It's wasting money.
Which administration? Was it Reagan or first Bush that started the process of an education here? Just say no. Do you remember how far back
that was? George W. Bush. You mean the... Oh, just say no about drugs?
Yeah.
That was under Nixon, and that was
I thought that
his wife's whole idea.
Okay, I thought...
Just say no was under...
Nixon's wife? I thought it was Reagan's wife.
What was her name? Nancy.
No, Nancy Reagan.
No, it was Nancy Reagan. You're right. We went back to Nancy Reagan.
I mean, didn't you think that was like the turning point of something more powerful? Because it seems like, education at home, just say no. It was really, now they're talking about above the influence. They've really come up with some creative ways to affect the influence, especially the younger people. The war on drugs, I mean, in reality, if you put all that money into the education process, that makes a heck of a lot more sense, doesn't it?
Sometimes they have found that, for example, the anti-smoking ads have had tremendous effect on young people.
Right.
Although other groups, women and third world people that can't see our anti-smoking PSAs, have increased the amount of smoking worldwide.
Right.
But I think there are ways that the media and the money can be well spent to turn around drug addiction and smoking and other things that we pretty much agree on are not good for our health and are good for our society. And so I'm just saying, U.S. Conference of Mayors, look what they did. And what's happening? Nothing in our state, nothing in our nation that agrees with our mayors of the cities who see they're on the front lines. They're the biggest, smallest elected office in the U.S.
That's true. And in the local government, they do know. They have an intimate understanding of their, because every little pocket has their own specific issues, and I think they have an intimate knowledge of those. I agree that this is a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's a good idea or not, but in the paper, just two more stories. First, they have a picture in section 1C of students from the Summit Academy High School.
Right.
Which I think is in Detroit. I'm not sure. Is that a Dearborn?
I think it is a Dearborn.
Summit Academy High School?
Yeah, and I think they conned their teachers effectively. Yeah. Do you?
Well, they want, of course, one of the goals, I guess, in their program is to definitely... Oh, no, it's a Romulus charter
school. Is it Romulus?
Yeah, okay. Down in Romulus there, Summit Academy. They wanted to teach them about diversity, about different cultures. Tuesday came lessons on Greek culture in the area, and on Wednesday on Mexican culture, all taught through discussions with presenters, films, music, and more. But on Thursday, their field trip began with a visit to the Arabic Shatila Bakery in Dearborn on Warren Road, Shatila, where the students sampled traditional pastries and learned how they're made.
Hmm.
Then they went on down and took a ride on Detroit's People Mover from Greektown to the Rensen and back. Now, I don't think eating Arabic or Middle Eastern pastries or riding on the People Mover looking down on Greektown is necessarily going to teach them much about diversity. But if they've never been outside of Romulus, maybe
right.
doesn't hurt. They look really to be enjoying the pastries.
Well, I tell you that I've looked like that as well. I think diversity food is a common thing in different cultures. You know what I mean? Like I know that
everybody needs to eat.
Everybody needs to eat, and I think for me anyway, the food part of it is a great way to learn, as long as there's other things that go with that. For instance, my son who went to Etzel Ford High School went to Chicago with his to the Latino part of Chicago. With his Spanish class, they danced, they ate, they did. That was a whole big cultural event, and I'm hoping that there's more than just eating pastries involved in this.
Well, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's lessons, handouts, discussions that teachers do after the fact.
Right.
And everybody needs a good field trip that's fun and entertaining too,
right.
to look forward to. The Shatila Bakery, and this is not a commercial for them though, but my daughter took me there for the first time. My first experience there was just about a month or so ago, and it is set up like a little oasis type, in the desert, an oasis in the desert with some fake palm trees, and you eat and dine in sort of the circular area, and as you need more food, you just sort of go to the outside edge. About half of the perimeter is the different food counters from a variety of different pastries and cookies and things that might be called baklava. People might be familiar with that, and real cakes, fancy decorated cakes.
Fruit cake, sure.
So it's quite a gourmet dining experience of desserts, and they do have some other food too that they serve there. I think it's more than desserts.
I've only eaten their desserts.
I mean, once you're there, why would you eat a sandwich? I mean, it's just when you see the display of the pastries. Yeah. So we wish them well, the students from Romulus. I don't know if students from Dearborn have ever gone there, but well, whatever good thoughts you get about other cultures, I like the quote, the one girl, and this requires heavy thought, one of the students